This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Carl Valeri about aviation careers, including the current employment outlook, some industry trends, and the wide availability of scholarships. In the news, we look at the Boeing acquisition of ForeFlight, the crash of an Ethiopian 737 MAX 8, FOD on the new KC-46 tankers, a pilot leaves his handgun on the plane, and a passenger with an RPG. We also talk about Sun and Fun, where we expect to see many of you this year. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 543 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
And I just topped out of one a few hours ago. Hello, Max. How you doing?
All right. I tell you, it's so strange to say, hey, Max, to another Max. It just feels odd when you're talking to somebody with the same name as you.
We've been doing this for 5 years. It feels normal to me. I talk to you more than I do my wife.
don't let her hear that.
Not true.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and, well, military aviation expert, too. Hi, David.
Hey, how are we? I'm exhausted. The long national nightmare is over. I actually started a new job today, so I'm back to running home, shoving food down my throat, and recording on Monday night. So we'll see how awake I am in a couple of hours.
I hope so. So good. You made it through the day. So that's, and you didn't get yourself fired on the first day. So that's a good sign.
Yeah, that's a good sign.
Well, our guest this episode is Carl Valeri. Carl's a flight instructor and airline pilot. He hosts Aviation Careers Podcast and, of course, the Stuck Mike Avcast. You'll find him on Sun and Fun Radio, and he coaches the Polk State Flight Team. Carl, welcome to Airplane Geeks.
Hey, guys. It's great to be back. It's been a long time since I've been here.
It is. It's been, I'm not even sure how long it's been, but it's been quite a while. It's been years. Stuck Mike Avcast, you guys just passed a big milestone.
We did. Actually, both in Stuck Mike and Aviation Careers, 200 episodes. And so we were pretty excited about that. We haven't missed a podcast in 7 years, and we bring one out the 1st and the 15th. And it's a general aviation podcast about learning to fly, living to fly, and loving to fly. We do everything from some news items, but primarily we go out in the field and record things like air shows and have guests on and talk about different aviation topics. All general aviation related, primarily, I should say. Been a lot of fun, but thanks for that.
Yeah, and it's a great show, too. It's always in my playlist. My playlist is too long. That's the problem. There's too.
So is mine.
Oh, man, there's so many aviation podcasts, good aviation podcasts. It's hard to keep up. We do our best. Well, why don't we get started with some of the aviation news from the past week? So I'll ask, are you guys ready?
Ready from the west.
Ready from the east.
And ready from runway 23 here at Lakeland Linder Airport.
Our first story is Boeing acquires ForeFlight. And ForeFlight, of course, provides software for flight planning, particularly mobile flight planning, I guess. Their products are used by individual pilots, professional flight crews, flight departments, and others. Max T, maybe can you give us a little more detail about how ForeFlight is used, and then we'll talk about their acquisition by Boeing.
Sure. The name ForeFlight came from the original concept, which was it was to be used before the flight for planning purposes. And it's really evolved into an all-singing, all-dancing application that pilots use in many, if not all, phases of flight. So it's got really an all-inclusive application that has just about anything a pilot might want to have all in one place.
Now, they were founded in 2007. Their headquarters are in Houston, Texas. But they have additional offices in Austin, Texas, and Portland, Maine. I didn't know about the Portland, Maine location. I wonder if Mike has ever been up there. But they have about 180 employees. And in Boeing's press release, they say that Boeing and 4Flight have had a relationship for over the last 2 years. The two partnered to incorporate Jeppesen's aeronautical data and charts into 4Flight. Jeppesen used to be separate, but they were acquired by Boeing as well sometime previously.
Yes, that's correct.
So now Boeing has acquired 4Flight. The president, the vice president of Boeing Digital Solutions and Analytics, that's Ken Sain, says this acquisition expands Boeing's rapidly growing, unparalleled digital services portfolio, which will enable us to compete and win in the $2.8 trillion 10-year services market. I guess there's been a little bit of concern on the part of GA pilots anyway. I think we've seen some of that raised in some of the forums and on Slack, wondering if 4Flight is, through its association with Boeing, is going to leave the little guys behind. But I don't know, any thoughts on that?
Well, they started very much in general aviation, of course, in the early days. I don't think you were allowed to use things like that on the flight deck. But over the years, they've moved both into military and commercial areas. And I think the big question in people's minds has been, gosh, will I be forced at some point in the future to use Jeppesen charts, which are more expensive than the government charts, now that both of those companies are owned by Boeing? And I have seen something on the 4Flight website that says, no, that's not true. So I think for folks who want to continue using the government charts, that's good news.
Carl, are you a 4Flight user?
I am 4Flight for general aviation, and I actually every so often have followed it in the airline. And boy, I tell you, what a great device! And it's great for training. And I'm not worried at all, to be honest with you. After Tyson's interview, the CEO of 4Flight, or President 4Flight, he actually really set my worries aside, because I kind of had that also feeling kind of in my gut, like, oh my gosh, are we going to turn it to something that's more just for the airlines? I really don't, because of his roots and because of his passion in general aviation, I really don't feel he's going to leave us behind, us general aviation pilots, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's kind of the impression I got as well when I watched the AOPA Live interview, or Tom Haines interviewed Tyson. Tom asked specifically about GA, and Tyson did respond, just like you guys have said, our roots are in GA, he said. Tom also asked him about, will the price points change? And Tyson said, not for GA, not planning on it. Both 4Flight and Jeppesen now are part of Digital Solutions and Analytics, which is headed by Ken Sain. And all that is under Boeing Global Services. So, another comment that came from that interview I thought was interesting is, when asked, will there be some reduction in the number of jobs as a result of this? And Tyson said, no. In fact, they're hiring. They're looking to hire more people. In fact, they're opening an office in Denmark. So that's fairly interesting. So it sounds like, at least for the present time, no one has any real reason to be concerned about the 4Flight that they love and use all the time.
You know, as an aside, we actually had looked at the airline I work for using 4Flight initially, and we went with a different company, and I think that has come back again, the discussion. And I really hope, because it is such a robust tool that I feel has not only been supported well, but is also growing with aviation, general aviation, also with the airlines. I really hope in the future we switch to that, because it the ease of use, it's a wonderful device. But obviously in the airlines, it takes a little while to change anything, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does. Large aviation corporations are conservative and slow-moving generally, things don't change really quickly. All right. Well, why don't we move on to let's talk about the Ethiopian crash. This was, of course, an Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 8. It was headed for Nairobi, Kenya. It crashed 6 minutes after taking off from the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. All 157 people on board flight ET-302 were killed. There were 149 passengers and 8 crew. And this just happened. So those of you listening to this a few days from now when we record this probably know more than we know right now. But there's a lot of stories in the press, maybe even too many, that are also looking at the Lion Air crash in Indonesia, which was also a 737 MAX 8.
Yeah, and I think there's been a lot of early speculation that, oh my gosh, this must be the same cause, and I think that's way too early to know that. And I think it's we've seen so often from accidents in the past that the early speculation turns out to be absolutely, totally incorrect. So, yeah, it's just way too early to know. It's interesting that a couple of the regulators around the world have grounded these. So the regulator of aviation in China apparently has grounded them, as they have in a couple of other countries as well. Here in the U.S. and the European countries have not done that. So I think in general, they believe that this may be an isolated incident. But, of course, we just don't know.
Yeah, John Ostrower and others, but John in his Air Current publications, has noted that regarding the Chinese decision to ground the planes for now, that's a pretty big deal because the size of the Chinese market, the role that will play in the future of Boeing, and it's not a very good thing. A lot of the articles I've been seeing, though, talk about what a terrible thing this is for Boeing. And I mean beyond just the fact that there was this accident, which of course is terrible in and of itself, but talking about the future of Boeing, or already making predictions about what the impact is going to be, which I think is a little premature. The stock went down today, Monday, as we record this, the day after. It was down 9% in pre-market trade. And it recovered somewhat, and it closed around down 5%, plus or minus a little bit. I didn't see it at the very end of the day. So the market, anyway, was in a little bit of a turmoil over the stock as a result of this. All right, we have a story from Kansas.com. Air Force won't accept more KC-46 tankers until they're cleaned of debris. We previously reported that the U.S. Air Force has been finding foreign object debris, or FOD, in the delivered KC-46 tankers from Boeing. They found things like loose tools and trash and other items. So what we have here is that Reuters reporting that no tankers have been accepted since February 20th, and none will be until aircraft are cleared of foreign debris and Boeing implements a corrective plan.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of the original Apollo 1, in which they found tools and things like that in the capsule after they tore it down after the fire. I'm sure the Air Force has similar feelings, which is that just can't be safe to have loose items rattling around inside an aircraft.
Yeah, and such things have been the cause for all kinds of incidents and accidents over the years, to the point where, and I think we've talked about this a little bit, but to the point where the elimination of that is kind of a key part of almost any aviation company's quality plan or quality system. So if this is happening with Boeing on the tankers, in a way that's more than just an isolated kind of an incident, it's a little concerning. And it is to the Air Force. They're not taking deliveries until this is corrected.
There seems to be a culture issue with this aircraft. I mean, it's not been a good week for Boeing. Let's put it that way. But it is kind of disturbing that this kind of lack of quality control is being pushed down the line at Boeing. And it goes to support the argument the Air Force has had for a while now that Boeing doesn't really care about the military contract. All it cares about is pumping out 737s. And it makes you wonder if that culture is leading to other issues like the 737 problems. I don't know, but you know, it is a serious thing finding nuts and bolts and screws, and you just don't expect that from an aircraft manufacturer, and it's not something Boeing has got to have a culture change right now, because they're getting it on both sides now. So I don't know how you fix it.
Yeah, back in my jet engine days, this was something we took really, really seriously, because, you know, whereas a loose tool in an airframe is, you know, one thing, having a loose washer floating around inside of a jet engine is a whole other thing. So yeah, that was something we took really seriously.
You know, I was wondering if maybe they've been hiring rapidly and if that's a source of the problem. I just pulled up the statistics, and they have actually had one of the biggest hiring years that they have had in, it looks like, probably a couple of decades. So they went from, in 2017, 140,000 people to 153,000. So they added more than, right around 10% of their workforce. I can remember when I was at Hewlett-Packard times, so I was in divisions that were growing rapidly, and you had 10% of the workforce in 1 year. There's just a lot of culture that doesn't fully get passed down immediately to new employees. So yeah, I'm just wondering if that might be contributing to the problem.
Yeah, that is a lot to absorb.
Could it also be maybe product line specific? I couldn't imagine this happening in some of the aerobatic planes I've flown. Obviously, we talk about FOD, and is it just specific to this aircraft, or has it happened in others? And it just brings back memories of, are you sure you buckled everything down? We don't have any garbage in the airplane, and just take it inverted, and all of a sudden all this stuff goes all over the canopy of the aircraft. Yeah. And that's what I was envisioning during this. But it's KC-46. Is it company wide? That's the question.
Right. I think it seems to be more KC-46 related, which that in and of itself is a big clue, if that's the case. But yeah, that's one of the first things I think you'd look at is how pervasive is it? That'll tell you a lot. But yeah, I remember the first time I was upside down in an airplane. Actually, I only once have I been upside down in an airplane. And I was surprised at how much sand and grit and stuff there is that's suddenly inverted in the airplane.
That's why the first time you go flying inverted, you want to do it in an open cockpit so that stuff doesn't hang around.
Yeah, clean it out.
I was just trying to envision you climbing into your seat upside down. How'd you put the seatbelt on if you were upside down in your seat? That's what I want to know.
Oh, I didn't climb in upside down.
Okay.
All right. This is from 660 City News. Pilot left gun behind in the cockpit of a Delta plane. Usually it's passengers who, quote, forget they had a handgun in their carry-on, but Max T, this time was different.
I'm always surprised by stories like this, and maybe I shouldn't be. I suspect that people who carry guns with them on a regular basis may tend to just kind of treat them as, I don't even want to speculate. Maybe they get used to them. That's probably the best way to say it. Now, I don't carry a gun, and so I would certainly, if I were carrying one the first couple of times, I'd be thinking about it all the time. But I think if you carry it for a long time, then you may not be thinking about it quite as much. And apparently, that may have contributed to this gentleman left the flight deck and left his gun behind. Now, of course, these are all in locked cases. That's just part of the program. So it's not as if anybody would have gotten access to the weapon. So in terms of, the impact, I would say this certainly didn't put anybody at risk. But it's really just kind of a surprise that, an airline pilot would forget to do something like that. And I would imagine that this will probably, result in him either, being suspended from the flight deck officer program. But I don't really know. Carl, what do you think?
Well, I was going to comment, this actually happens more often than is placed in the media, obviously, and it happens more often than I think people want to realize and want to know about, but it's interesting because, like you said, first of all, the gun is, or the weapon is actually stored locked, and it's in, say, a separate container than your other flight bag equipment, and it can easily be left behind in that, and obviously obviously can't give away certain things about the program, but just think about a bag being left next to you and then standing up in a dark cockpit. That could be a dark bag, and you leave it behind. In the past, when I've found, say, something like this in the cockpit, usually you just call the crew member, say, hey, listen, come back here and retrieve this. But it's not... You know, it's tough because you should be aware of everything happening, but I can see people, and this mistake will continue to happen, but hopefully we will try to be more vigilant. But I don't see it happening that often in the cockpit. And the this federal flight deck program, the flight deck officer program, is a huge volunteer police force out there, and it's incredible. These people step up and volunteer to go to training all throughout the year, and sometimes, you know, accidents happen. At least it wasn't you know, like in my mind, safety related, because it was a locked gun. But this can happen more than I think people realize. I think too, the other thing that people don't realize is how many people are actually on aircraft that are carrying weapons that are with the federal government, say, and even ones that aren't with the federal government. So, as far as safety is concerned, I don't think there really was a safety issue here. But I tell you, he won't make this mistake again. And hopefully other people won't and learn from this. That's for sure.
Oh, he just wanted a hamburger. He was hungry. He dropped everything and ran out to the terminal to eat.
Bolted. I think there's another factor as well. Carl, I think that you raise a really excellent point I hadn't thought about, you know, being a dark environment. I know there have been times when I've been looking, you know, for a black item on a black carpet, you know, in the back of the Cirrus. And, you know, you can spend a long time looking for it and not finding it. And it's right there. So in a dark cockpit, I totally understand that. I could guess that maybe fatigue might be an issue as well. You know, end of the day, last flight. I would imagine it's probably a lot easier when you're thinking about, gee, I'd just love to get to my hotel tonight to overlook something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I've left my flashlight behind. It was in a similar type of case, and it can just as easily have been a weapon that was left behind. One obviously is much more important than the other not to leave behind. You know, even this is bad, but even worse can be accidentally bringing it to another country. That gets to be a whole other sticky situation.
Ooh, boy,
Like I said, though, I am so appreciative of all those out there that are, you know, listening, that are in the Federal Flight Deck Officer Program, and they go through some amazing training, and I'm sure that this will be placed in that training program. And then as an example of what can happen and the mistakes that have been made in the past, and we learn from those mistakes, and that's why we listen to cockpit voice recorders and we do go to training. So it's just an unfortunate event, and thank God nothing bad happened. Let's put it that way.
Well, you know what occurs to me is this industry loves checklists. And this sounds like a good checklist item. I mean, is there a you know, end of flight exiting the cockpit kind of checklist?
Yeah, we call it the embarrassing items checklist.
Ah, okay.
keys, IDs, and passport, and embarrassing items checklist. This, I think, would be part of that embarrassing items checklist. I would not say, I would say that they probably have their own checklist, but that wouldn't obviously be included because not everybody's a federal flight deck officer in the cockpit.
Yeah.
So it is going to happen again, but hopefully we will reduce the number by pointing this out. And that's the only thing that I really think will be positive coming from this being placed out there in the press. But anyway, hats off to those guys that do serve it at their own cost, by the way. They have to go to the training at their own cost and take time off. So hats off to them for doing that. Yes, sir. Yeah. And it really take time away from family, and they go through constant training on their own and have to take the time off to do it.
The program issues them the handgun, though. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have to purchase that.
No. Yeah, so everything else. But their time is their time, so they have to take vacation or take time off to do this. It is a volunteer force. It's a volunteer force, remember. So, and like I said, it's just, I think it's a great program because you never know who's where, what, when, you know, and that's a big part of it.
Sure.
And it's it is an eye-opening experience and as far as security is concerned. And I feel incredibly safe in the U.S., especially when it comes to air security and airline security, just from, you know, what I've learned through that program.
Right.
Well, I think it's a great program, and I hope we talk about it all the time, and everybody in the world becomes aware of it. And they don't ever even think about trying to get into a cockpit, you know, knowing what might be waiting for them on the other side. So, yeah, it's an awesome deterrent.
Yes, it is.
Of course, if you're trying to do something like that, I mean, you could come heavily armed. We see in KSNT.com, TSA agents find rocket-propelled grenade launcher in luggage. Oh, oh, my goodness.
Yes, well, there is that. This one caught my attention simply because, you know, we see stories all the time about people bringing prohibited items onto the aircraft. This probably isn't on the prohibited list because nobody ever thought you'd bring an RPG onto an airplane. Yeah, and I think I've seen a subsequent story that said it might have been a replica. And this one says that the grenade portion was a replica. But nonetheless, I can imagine that the people who were, you know, inspecting said, what the heck do we have here? So, yeah, I mean, this is something that's a, you don't find as a, you know, a civilian type of weapon. This is a weapon of war. So, yeah, pretty stunning to find an RPG that someone wants to, you know, bring along with them on their flight.
Yeah, and according to this report anyway, the man who did this told officials that he thought he could bring it on board in a checked bag because it was non-functioning. But the security equipment alarm went off. This was at Lehigh Valley International Airport in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is not too far from Philadelphia, where one of
our home state.
I know.
You know, there's three people who are local to that Philadelphia. Well, Trescott isn't anymore, but Carl is kind of on my side about being a Jersey boy.
Yes. I was born in Philadelphia.
So be careful what you say. You're outnumbered there.
I guess
you
I am.
Flight.
I guess I am. It just seems like a lot of these wacky things happening. Well, the guy was from, apparently was from Florida. So maybe Pennsylvania's off the hook.
There you go. That explains it, of course.
I get it now.
But of course.
But by the way, it worked. I mean, they found it, right?
Yes. That's exactly the, yes. Exactly.
I thought you meant the weapon worked.
No.
The TSA security protocols worked,
and you can see it. They would just find it and go, "Hey, let's see if this thing works."
Yeah,
great.
That'd be fun.
Sure.
So all of this, the replica grenade and the unassembled parts of the launcher were all confiscated by the TSA, and the man continued on his flight. Even made his flight to Orlando. But the lesson is that no realistic or replica weapons of a military nature are allowed onto airplanes. We've talked about firearms and putting them in checked luggage, but replicas or realistic military-type weapons are just not allowed.
Yeah, if you're going to do something crazy on an airline, don't bring one of these. Bring your emotional support emu instead.
And they're cutting back on those, too.
Yeah, they are.
But I tell you, this it's funny because it really, we have come a long way in detecting this type of equipment. I don't do this anymore, but I have in the past. I volunteered to do to try to bring things through security screenings.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a really interesting, I'm usually sweating bullets as I'm going through because of the fact that not everybody is in tune with what I'm trying to do. And it's a test to, you know, I'm in civilian clothes, obviously, when I'm doing it, but it's a test to the system. And it's really interesting because if the person doesn't catch it right away, they're done. And I have been in one where the person did not catch it. I brought something through that looked like three sticks of dynamite and a timer on top, and it got past the guard in the screening. But this was prior to 9/11. After 9/11, that never would have happened because they have changed a lot of their procedures, and I'm really happy about that. So I'm glad that they caught this too.
Yeah. So these days, if it went undetected, the security official would lose his job. Is that what you're saying?
Well, and it depends if they're being tested at that point. A lot of this stuff, especially in the hold, has been automated, and there's so it'll pop up and it'll give them a warning. But if they don't heed that warning, then yes, that person will be, they immediately are pulled off the line immediately. And depending on their situation, they could either go through retraining or they might lose their job if they're on a probationary status.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just curious. So who initiates or orchestrates the test? Is it the airline or the TSA?
It's various agencies.
Okay.
That do that. Yeah, but it comes from, you know, airport authorities will also initiate that. And that type of thing. So there's different people that'll put that forth. But it's about all I can say about that program.
Okay.
But yeah, it's cool that they do that.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. You want the system tested to make sure that it's producing the results that we all want.
By the way, I don't do that anymore. So if you're looking at me online, you're a TSA agent. Don't look at me with higher scrutiny, please.
Yeah. All right. Here comes Carl. Better watch out. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And I'm just worried about what happens if they do find it and they suddenly get excited and wrestle you to the ground.
Yes.
And things like that. I mean, isn't there the potential for possibly being injured for volunteering to test?
That is correct, and that you have hopefully there's a couple different people that know about what's going on, but most of the other folks don't. That is the one downside. But remember, most of these agents don't have weapons with them. It's the police force is what really worries me, and the local police or something like that, and that gets you nervous. That's why I just don't volunteer for that anymore, because I started thinking along those lines. As I've gotten older, I'm a lot more careful with certain things that I do, and that's one of them.
Yeah, yep. And that's how we got to be older, right?
Amen.
By making conservative decisions. I mean, that's what I'm telling pilots all the time. When you have a choice between alternate courses of action, choose the more conservative, less risky one. We want to build margin into everything we do so that we, if something goes wrong, there's still some extra margin of safety to protect us.
Yeah, very much agree. Great, well said.
Again, we're speaking with Carl Valeri, flight instructor, airline pilot, host of Aviation Careers Podcast and the Stuck Mike Avcast. Carl, I always view you as maybe being the one guy around who has a great sense of the aviation job market, and not just pilots, but all aspects of the industry. Certainly, Aviation Careers Podcast covers a lot of different angles in the job market. Generally, though, how does it look these days? I mean, we hear about shortages of pilots and as well as mechanics, and that sounds like it ought to be a great time to be thinking about entering the aviation industry. Is that accurate?
I think you are correct about that. And I think that in general, we're having a labor shortage, especially in the U.S., but even in most of the world, most places. But aviation has truly been hit. But not just in pilots. I know we always talk about the pilots, but there are so many other areas out there that there is a shortage. I've been talking about this for years and did an episode back in episode 50 about the truth about the pilot shortage, and all that still stands today. And we can talk a little bit about that. But yes, the job market right now for aviation, for pilots, for flight attendants, for mechanics, for managers, for people that repair the jetways, for those folks that get into revenue management, decide what we're going to do for pricing and where we're going to send our airplanes, and the folks that are in the technical aspects of putting flights together, say flying overseas, etc. There's all sorts of jobs there. One, you look at the pilot job and you say, oh yeah, that's a great job, but there's about 6 to 8 other people behind that pilot in the corporation that helped that run. Ticketing, computers, there's so many jobs just around aviation, and having that expertise really does help, that's for sure.
And that's an aspect of this industry that I thought was always wonderful, and that being that, you can have an interest in aviation just for whatever reason. Maybe you just like airplanes. It could be any reason. Your training, your specialty, your career could be in something that's not even related at least on first look, to aviation. But you can find that kind of a job within the aviation industry. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure. I mean, look at guys that are dispatch. I live in an area where CSX is a railroad company, and they have dispatchers, a lot of trucking companies here. And then people look at the airplanes that are right here at the airport and say, God, I wish I could get into that. I'm like, well, you can. You're a dispatcher. All you need to do is get your dispatch license so that you can become a dispatcher. And the dispatcher is somebody who, along with the captain of the flight, agree as to the safety of that flight. And both of them have to sign off on the fact that that flight can be made and made safely. The dispatcher plans a flight, usually takes care of a lot of the paperwork. The captain signs off on that, and then they go forward. And not only you're not done that there, you actually monitor those flights. And there's whole centers of people that are dispatchers, people that specialize in just being a liaison with the FAA, trying to decide, okay, which flights are going to be able to get into Philadelphia today through certain areas, through certain gates, as they call it, and which flights will be canceled. So there's so many different positions out there that are available. If you love airplanes, you love aviation, you definitely can get into it now.
Has, you know, with 200 and plus episodes under your belt now, have things changed? Is the landscape different in some way, or the kinds of people who are interested in aviation careers, are they somewhat different than when you first started this?
I think it's changed a little bit in that you see many more people saying they can do this, whereas you saw this kind of in the late 90s, early 2000s, where people that would never consider a job, say, flying an airplane, that has changed. The other thing that has changed tremendously and radically, I should say, is the fact that there are so many organizations out there trying to help people to get into aviation through, you know, the STEM program, science, technology, engineering, and math, and people that help design aircraft engines and help, you know, sell aircraft engines. They're really trying to get all these people into this field, and that has really changed. As far as other parts of it, I can talk a little bit about that. As far as the trends in the pilot hiring, one thing that's happened is, and this is something that my program at Aviation Careers Podcast has kind of morphed into a lot of airline jobs and as far as flying planes, but I wanted all airline jobs to be represented. But because of the fact that it's really the airline pilot is the one thing that everybody wants to become, and now they're realizing, oh, I can do this, we're seeing a few things happening. And there's a couple little trends in the industry we can talk about. One of them, which is really surprising to most people, we did see this back in 99, 2000, were that the lack of instrument skills. Now, what is that? Instrument flying skills. That's the ability to fly in the clouds, which you have to have as an airline pilot. As a matter of fact, that's one of the more important things. And we're seeing a lack of knowledge even still with instrument flying. Learn, you know, what do you do during approach? And you're supposed to know what altitude you have to be at, what airspeeds, et cetera, whether you can actually do the approach, that type of thing. One of the reasons that's happening is because of this new 1,500-hour rule. So what does that mean? Now, in the past, you had to be a commercial pilot. A commercial pilot means that you are somebody that can be paid to fly an airplane. The captain of the flight has to have their airline transport pilot license. Well, now because of the new rules, everybody has to have their airline transport pilot license. They call it the 1,500-hour rule. That's not necessarily correct, and we'll go into that later, but you normally have to have 1,500 hours to become an airline transport pilot so you can get hired as a first officer at an airline. How do you build those hours, though? You're going from a couple hundred hours as a commercial pilot to an airline pilot. Well, some people will start towing, say, gliders, or they'll start doing any type of pipeline patrol. They're flying out there looking outside the aircraft, flying by the seat of their pants. They're not flying using instruments. Then what happens? They get hired by an airline because they have the numbers. They've checked the box, because trying to find folks that are qualified, because there's a real shortage of qualified pilots, meaning they don't have that 1,500 hours, it's really tough to find those folks. So you have it, boom, you're in. They find, though, that they don't have quite the instrument skills. So really, that's something that I've seen a lot of. The other thing, too, is one of the things that we start seeing in this trending is the fact that our you know, we talk about pay, and I've said this many years ago that I don't see much of a change in the airline pilot pay, the beginning, the starting pay. It has come up, but not as much as you think. And follow me here. The pay rates have gone up, but the real thing that's attracting people is the first year bonuses. The bonuses have gone up. So we're seeing the rates go up a little bit, but the bonuses, there's people that are starting at the airlines making $70,000 a year with all these bonuses. Now, that's a ton of money. When I started back in the, you know, the 90s, it was if you could make $14,000 a year, you were happy, or even less. So now what they're doing is they're throwing bonuses at you for signing on with them, and this pay rates, they're still talking about $35,000 a year, but you're getting a bonus check for like $30,000 or $35,000, or they're including other things in that. We're also seeing a lot more things like the fact that they're bringing people in to the airlines. We talked about the 1,500-hour rule. They're hiring people, okay? This is called a conditional hire. This is happening throughout the industry where they'll find somebody has their instrument rating. They will interview them and give them a conditional hire, meaning, hey, you're an airline pilot now. Just call us when you're about 100 hours before you get your total of 1,500 hours. So what they're going to do when you get there, when you actually have close to that 1,500 hours, they're going to say, okay, what do you need now? Well, I need to get my multi-engine commercial. Okay, we'll pay for that. Or you pay for the multi-commercial, then you come over to us and we'll get you your multi-engine time in the simulator. So that's been an interesting trend. I mean, think about that. I mean, they're putting people into simulators and they're paying for some of this. So I think there's some people out there that are starting to say on the internet, why don't the airlines pay for some of this training if there is such a shortage? They are starting that trend. But it's not all the way down the line where they're paying for everything. Does that, you know, see what I'm saying? It's not there yet where they pay for every single degree.
Now, are we talking about entry through the regionals or, mm-hmm. or the mainline?
The regionals. So we'll start there. And thanks for clarifying that. When you start off, you're going to go to the regional airlines. And then the regional airlines feed to the major airlines. And one of the things we're really seeing a shortage of is at the regionals. Remember, most of the flying done at the airlines, most of the flights that are done, not number of passengers, but most of the flights are done by the regionals. So that means you're going from one point out in the middle of Pennsylvania to Philadelphia, connecting them to a larger plane that goes to Paris, that type of thing. What's happening there is you're seeing the people that are getting hired getting those hours in the simulator. The major airlines, no. They believe there's enough people out there to fill the major airline. The airline I'm with, we put out requests for pilots, and we'll get 10, 20 times the number we need as far as applicants. At the regional airlines, it's just the opposite. As a matter of fact, another thing that's happening at the regionals, and this is interesting, they're sending some of their people home. Remember I said, hey, they'll bring you in, fly in their simulator. Well, you know what? The simulators are too busy. They're hiring too many pilots. So what they're doing is this, and I've seen this happen at the college, at Polk State College, where I help out with the flight team. They're sending the students back, giving them a check and saying, here, go fly an airplane and build your hours. I'm like, wow, that sure has changed. It's absolutely incredible. But yeah, most people, what they'll do is they'll build their hours at a regional airline, and then they'll get hired with a major. The airlines that are out there, the major airlines, the legacies, the low cost, the ones that are more in demand from people, the ones that people want to go to, usually their requirements might be a little bit tougher, or they have more applicants so they can weed out more people. In other words, say, oh, their minimums are 3,000 hours of total pilot time. Well, in reality, it might take you 5,000 hours. Or if it's in an airline that not a lot of people want to go to because maybe their pay is not good, they don't have great bases, then their numbers are going to go down. They're going to say, okay, well, we'll forego the fact that you need a, 4-year degree, a bachelor's, that type of thing, which is something that a lot of people don't realize. The FAA license is a license to fly an airplane. Outside of that, there's also a bachelor's degree, and you can get that in anything you want to. But to continue on to some of the other things that are really interesting, within that bonus structure, I always tell people, look at the bonus structure, because you don't know what you're really getting until you read the fine print. And the fact that these people are really wanting you to fly for the airlines is great. but things will change. And also another thing you have to do, and most of my data is empirical data. I love Boeing and I love looking into the future, but I get hit with this right away because I'm doing a lot of the interview prep. That's actually how we make our money. We do interview prep, we do resume review and that type of thing. I work with recruiters at the different airlines that come on the show. Is that, you know, you got to look at that and look at that situation and see, you know, what's happening with that airline today, because the airline today that's the best airline to work for may be the worst next month, and vice versa. And we've seen that happen throughout the industry. Another really cool thing is my friends in Australia. I love all of our listeners in Australia, wonderful people. I've actually done a lot of interview prep for guys that are coming and gals coming from Australia to the U.S. is this new E3 visa program, especially for foreign pilots in Australia. And they don't have quite the shortage we have here. It's a little tougher to get on with the regionals there. So a lot of them are coming here for many reasons. They might want to, you know, live here. They see the pay rates, they see the bonus structures, and they're saying, hey, I want to jump on that. So they see the ability to get more hours also so they can move on. Some of the regionals that they're working for, like in Australia, they're not getting as many hours. In the U.S., they might get twice as many. So you're seeing some of that. As a matter of fact, just to preface one of my upcoming episodes, one of the airlines, a couple of the airlines are doing this. They're actually going out there and sponsoring these folks to come here at the regional level with the E3 visa to work here. So you don't have to be a citizen, but you do have to have this visa. If you're going to go to the majors, though, you normally will have to become a citizen, which you have plenty of time to do that while you're building time at the regional airlines. It's pretty neat. I mean, I think it's really exciting to see all this happening. Now, remember, I'm talking about pilots, but there's other people too. I mean, the flight attendants, they're having the same issues with those, or they're getting more aircraft, that type of thing. So they're growing there. The pilots themselves are being sucked up by the majors because there's so many retirements at the majors, plus they're growing somewhat. But I get this question all the time, you know, what do you think about the future and what's going to happen with the industry and the economy? I can guarantee you this, we'll probably have a recession in the next 20 years. Whatever you do, do it because you love it. Don't just look at today and look at the market today. Do it because you really love flying and you want to get into flying. You want to do this as a job. Don't go into it because you see the big paychecks, because believe me, I mean, I've been furloughed. I've been on the street for years trying to find a job and working for peanuts while the economy's been in a downturn a few times. And it does change things. And the people that don't truly love it, they wind up getting out of it. So that's been a big change. One more thing, by the way, on the whole, one other trend that I think's really, really exciting for me. I have a lot of Osprey pilots that are listeners, and a lot of folks that are out on ships, and I love what they're doing, and I really appreciate them and all the folks in the military. But one thing that we had done in the industry is told people, if you're a rotor pilot, if you're a helicopter pilot, that doesn't count. All those hours, you can just throw those away. It doesn't mean anything. You have to start from the bottom. Well, that's changed. That's totally changed in the past 5 years. Now they actually have what's called rotor transition programs. The regional airlines, and I work with a lot of recruiters that have these, they really like them. They think it's terrific. And the people that come in, they've been trained in the military in helicopters, and they're gonna help you. They're going to help you get your fixed wing license. So now you got to get a license to fly a fixed wing aircraft, a multi-engine. They get you, help you get that license. Many different fashions they do this, either at your own home airport or they send you to a specific school. But that's just awesome, because I've always said for years, they're pilots. They just do different things with their hands and their feet than we do. And they don't think at 500 miles an hour. That's about it. I mean, that's the only differences.
Yeah, it really feels like the qualities that you want in a pilot would be the same, you know, regardless of whether it was fixed wing or rotary. But like you say, I mean, the actual operation is of course different. But the fundamental qualities that make a good pilot, I would think would be pretty much the same.
And one thing that's great about the military is they can do so much more training in emergencies and things like that we can't do. And there's certain those helicopter pilots, especially a lot of those guys that are out there flying medevac and stuff like that, they have tons of IFR experience. I listen to these guys' stories when I'm doing interview prep. It's amazing. They don't stop. I mean, if there's somebody they need to get, they don't leave anybody behind, period. And they're flying in all sorts of conditions. They get here and an engine blows up. It's like, oh, yeah, engine blow up. Let's shut it down. Okay, now let's land. It's not a big deal. It's like it is when you're getting shot at. Nobody's shooting at you, which is a wonderful thing when you're flying here as a civilian. So it's definitely a big difference. And I'm so excited for those folks. And I've been, you know, kind of pushing that for years, and I'm just so happy to see that it's actually happening. The other thing that's happening, which I think is really cool, is the scholarships. I mean, there's so many more scholarships out there. We have a directory that we have online that we make available, and we constantly are updating it. And it, you know, once a month, it's super cheap. It's like $10 and you get a whole year access. But there's so many others out there, and you can look on the internet and do a Google search. But certain organizations like AOPA, hats off to them for doing so many scholarships, EAA, all these different folks that are out there, and they're giving scholarships to people of all different ages, of all different walks of life. Doesn't matter who you are. There's ones that are specific for women, men, for people that are Italian Americans, people that are Polish Americans, people that are coming from different countries into the U.S. And I think that's something that's really, really exciting. I have students that have had every single part of their training and all their college paid for through scholarships, and hats off to those folks for working on that. So there are scholarships from $500 all the way up to $56,000, and they're out there, which is really, really neat. And I'm like a big advocate of scholarships, of course, with the scholarships guide that we push. And one of the things that I've really seen is how it's changed people's lives. And they'll go in looking for a scholarship in a specific area, and then they'll find another and say, "Oh, wow, this is cool. I'm going to get a different rating," and they're just so darn excited about it. And I just love that fact. I think that's absolutely terrific.
Just to give people an idea of the scope of your scholarship directory, how many, you know, roughly, the scholarships are in there?
So we're kind of different in that we're pretty particular about what we put in there. So we only have about 200 different specific scholarships, individual scholarships, which give away about $50 million. There are many more. We have in the wings about $100 million that we still haven't put in there because we're not done verifying everything. I have a whole group of people. That's all they do is look at scholarships all day and try to find new ones. There's many different free ones out there, but we stick to the ones that we know are good and are administrated well. And also, if you are one that wants to give money away, please do, but go to a big organization like EAA and AOPA and those organizations. Do a scholarship in your name because they're very good at administering those scholarships. That's for sure.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you how many people I've hooked up doing that, and all those organizations are growing. As a matter of fact, last year at Sun and Fun, I do the Sun and Fun radio there. I tried to raise, put another $1 million into the scholarships guide that week. I got up to like $780,000, but still, imagine that. I found $780,000 of scholarships while I was walking around talking to people. You know, the Fly Girl movement, the I Fly movement, all those neat things that are out there, getting people into aviation. And by the way, there's a lot of listeners here and in general that are into aviation. It's not just scholarships for people that want to go into this as a career. It's for people that want to advance their ratings. Like, say you want to become a flight instructor or an instrument pilot. Or you want to become a glider pilot. The Arthur Godfrey Foundation, I mean, they give away glider scholarships. There's all sorts of neat stuff out there. And really, aviation does truly change people's lives. And I have seen this working with the students at Polk State College and other students. Is it changes who you are. It gives you a lot more confidence, especially when, you know, the other students ask you, "So what did you do this weekend?" "Well, you know, I went and I played golf." "What did you do?" "Well, I flew to Key West and then I went down to the Bahamas and had some conch chowder and then I came back." "Really? Wow." Then, you know, it's a different conversation from there, and it really has built the self-esteem of so many students and so many people. And that's what's gotten me so darn excited about aviation. Not just the flying. I love flying. I love being in the airplane and seeing the world from that incredible perspective, whether it's in a 172 or an Airbus, doesn't matter. But one of the things that even makes me more excited is when you see somebody grow and you see somebody get excited because they've been introduced to this new world and they have so much more self-confidence and they have the abilities to actually move forward in other ways and in other avenues of their life, not just in aviation, because of flying an airplane.
Carl, it sounds like you're kind of having fun these days.
Fun and no sleep. Fun and no sleep. I mean, I just don't. People ask me how I get all this done. I honestly, though, I have a wonderful staff of folks. Hats off to Russ, by the way, who's our scholarships coordinator. That without these people, I never could get all this done. And without all the folks volunteering on the Stuck Mike Avcast and also at Aviation Careers Podcast, all the staff there, there's no way I could do all this stuff. There's no way. And the flight team, of course, and I could talk a little bit about that if you want.
Yeah, the Polk State flight team. What's that about?
I mentioned it a few times. I probably should explain. They asked me if I could help coach a team at Polk State College. Polk State College used to be a two-year school here in Polk County, Florida, which is where Lakeland Linder Airport is, and that's where our college is, in the old flight safety simulator building, as a matter of fact. But anyway, we have a bachelor's degree. Well, in this environment, this college environment, there's competitions on all different levels. You know, you have chess, you have, you know, all math competitions. You also have flying competitions. NIFA, the National Intercollegiate Flight Association, now going into its 75th year, is a competitive organization that helps foster integrity and how to win with integrity by bringing people together into this environment of a flight competition, and not just flying, but also ground competitions. It's neat. They use what's called an E6B. They actually have to have a competition where they have to figure things out with this. It's basically a slide rule that I think everybody now is used to using computers to figure things out. They have competitions where they actually have to, you know, go out and figure out what type of aircraft that they're looking at in a picture out of this large manual called Jane's, All the World's Aircraft. They can pick any airplane out of that. They also do spot landings, precision landings. They do message drop and all these different competitions that are held regionally and then also nationally. And in the nationals, it's University of Wisconsin this year where the nationals are being held. We're in Region 9. We compete against a couple colleges, one called Embry-Riddle over on the East Coast.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
And some people may have heard of them. There's another one called FIT. We also have Jacksonville University, Florida State College, Auburn University. A lot of people don't realize the history behind Auburn University and their flight program. It's been out there for many, many years. But interestingly, the first NIFA competition and the first competition amongst the colleges actually was up in New York area, and one of the people that was on the team that actually won the competition, his name was Juan Tripp, and he went on to form an airline, Pan American Airlines, and Pan American Airways, I should say. And that is actually, it's got this really steep history in the competition, and it's really exciting. The most important thing to me is that the students, they actually learn how to win and win with integrity, but also the recruiters are at these events. So all the different airlines are there and they're out there recruiting at these events. And it's so exciting when they actually sometimes interview and they get a job just by being at that competition. And it says a lot to take your time off and to get involved in that. I think that's just awesome. That's for sure.
Now, are you still an active airline pilot despite all these other things going on?
So I am, but the caveat is I do a very, very reduced schedule compared to most people. So I don't know if you know much about it. We can talk a little bit about it. Airline pilots, usually they get about 15 days off a month. I do about 15 to 20 days off a month. So if you look at that, I have a lot of time to do other things. So I usually, like right now, I'm on a 10-day off stretch. Some people call that vacation. I just call it days off. And during those periods, I'm a big believer in volunteering. That was kind of instilled in my mantra in my life from my parents. So I do a lot of volunteering with the students at the college and other organizations, not just in aviation. I'm very much involved in some veterans organizations. But that's something that's really important because it's not all about the money. When you get to the point where you have your life settled, et cetera, you start realizing there's other things that are much more important, and instilling in people's lives what's truly important and also certain integrity and trying to put forth something that they'll be able to use in their lives and later on is that's your legacy. That's what you leave and that's what you should do. So if you're in a job that gives you a lot of time off, Yeah, go out there and do something. Volunteer, you know, start something. Make a difference. I mean, the scholarships guy for me is something that was really important in that, you know, like I said, it's only $10. We'll never make more than is given away, which is so cool for me to say that statement. But it's incredibly important because my mom was somebody that used to help people with, you know, getting scholarships and helping them actually fill out applications to get into college, people that just didn't have parents that were interested or whatever reason. And that's kind of been fulfilled through me. Unfortunately, my mom passed right before I published it. But so I think that in the back of my mind, that's kind of the reason that's if people are wondering why I do it and why I'm always talking about scholarships is I think I have that in the back of my head. I always think, hey, would my mom be proud of this? And that's kind of that's what keeps me going. I'll never know, but I always keep trying. That's for sure.
I think you maybe know. I think maybe you know.
I hope. But
so what are you flying these days?
Well, I'm flying an Airbus A320 and an A321. We have two different variants. The A321's a little bit longer, about 25 feet longer than the A320. It holds, in our configurations, anywhere from, say, 150 to about 200 passengers. And absolutely, I love flying that airplane. It's a fly-by-wire. What's really cool, I never thought I would like it, to be honest with you. I never liked autopilot. But I found that in an airplane like this that's highly automated, it's so much fun to try to think in front of the airplane and fly it smoothly because you can fly the plane a lot smoother than the computer can, and you have to figure out how to do that. And that's the real challenge is making good landings and trying to fly the aircraft smoothly and figure out the automation and stuff like that. It's always a challenge. People say, well, it does it all itself. Well, yeah, you're on autopilot, and I'm glad there's a lot of automation, that's for sure, especially we talked about fatigue before, you know. After 9 hours of flying, you want to be able to have the autopilot on when you're, you know, getting close to an airport and approaching. But I love the plane, and I love the automation. I love the width of it. I am a big Airbus fan, that's for sure. And I love the larger windows, et cetera. So, and it's a kick in the pants when all that power starts coming up, that's for sure.
Are you flying Neos?
I will be.
You will be?
I will be shortly, I think. That's a good question. I don't know when. But, yeah, in the next few years, we definitely will be getting a delivery of Neos. And I think I saw one of our tails that had no engines on it that was a Neo, which is kind of cool to see that. And it was really cool to be able to actually flew the first 321 that was flown or built in the assembled in the United States. So that was really cool to do that. And then I also, what was real neat is to be in Alabama where that's actually produced and be at Auburn University during one of our competitions and then see that same aircraft, the picture in Alabama and also the picture at the airline that I work for, which was pretty awesome. And that's been fun. As a matter of fact, I haven't been flying a lot of GA lately because I've been so busy. But the last experimental aircraft I ever flew was an Airbus, actually.
Really?
I got to do the certification flight for ADS-B for the Airbus A320, and it was really it was kind of a funny experience. But basically, I was the right seater. I was the first officer, and I was basically told not to touch anything. Of course, me being the curious person, it was experimental, so we had all this equipment in the airplane, and I started touching things, and all of a sudden, you know, I got L3 communications standing there, and everybody in the cockpit, and they're like, "What just happened?" And I was like, "Oh, I kind of touched this button," and it was hilarious because the FAA, the inspector that's doing the certification flight, of course, there's all these really smart pilots next to me, and says, they say, "Well, I can fix that," and they're like, no, we're going to have Carl try to fix it because he has no idea about this system and how to fix it. So I was like, well, let me see. I'd probably push this button and that button, and sure enough, it worked, and I was like, oh, thank God. And then the captain looks at me, and then he said, oh, I'll translate. He said, don't ever touch that again, but he said it in a different manner.
Yeah, I bet.
So I sat there for the rest of the flight.
Now, you said it was an experimental aircraft. So mm-hmm. How long did it take you to build that A321?
Well, it took about 3 hours or 4 hours to designate it as experimental. And just because it was modified to a point where it had to be considered experimental. So
I'm so used to EAA, experimental aircraft, means something you built yourself. So I just figured, boy, you're ambitious.
Yeah, no. I just, it was kind of funny, though, going to a cockpit that I'd been in for so long, and it didn't, a lot of stuff didn't look like it should be there, you know, and that was kind of interesting, but, and flew it over the Atlantic. But yeah, it's funny, you designate it as an experimental because of that, because it's been modified, right? So it's no longer a production aircraft. And that's why we were able to do these test flights, because it was an experimental. It had equipment in it that the aircraft doesn't have. So that was kind of, it was modified. What was interesting is now having to change it back so they can use it online. And that took a lot of money. But that was cool just to be able to do that. Airbus. It's just so cool to see on the side of an Airbus experimental. I just thought that
was
kind of neat.
Yeah.
but yeah, I tell you, all these things I do, like you said, it's just because I love doing it, and it's I have a lot of days off. One thing I will say, I'm a bit of a workaholic, and I have taken some time off to spend more with family and stuff. But still, I just love being out there. Even the days off, I wind up running by an airport. As a matter of fact, by the way, I don't know if you mind if I talked about the team and the flight team and stuff, and we have a competition, and it talks about how to identify an aircraft. We have these slides that are brought up on the screen, and we don't have very long, and we have to actually, you know, put an answer in there as to who the manufacturer is, and then actually what the name of the aircraft is, its designation, whatever is known in the real world. I was wondering, do you mind if I can maybe, you know, borrow Dave and ask him a question about an aircraft possibly?
Yeah, we don't charge much for Dave's time.
Well, Dave, you know, I tell you, one of the things that I've been showing this photograph to a lot of people, and we have the students weren't able to come up with an answer, and I had someone come really close to an answer on this, but we couldn't figure out what it is. I was wondering, maybe we could put it in the show notes. But David, you know, I know you know so much about airplanes, and I wanted to know this aircraft that I'm showing you a picture of, and the people that are listening now can look at the show notes. What in the world is that thing?
Well, you said it was a Republic aircraft to start, and you were in the right state, but you needed to go to Buffalo and not Long Island. Actually, it's a Bell P-63 King Cobra, which was the follow-on aircraft to the P-39 Aerocobra. And I will put Carl's picture in, and I will put a picture of the P-63 from the Air Force Museum in the show notes in its beloved orange color, which was a pinball aircraft. The P-63 in the United States Air Force wasn't used a lot during World War II. It was sent primarily overseas to the Soviet Union, who loved the P-39. The only two people who really loved the P-39 was the Russian Air Force and Chuck Yeager. The follow-on aircraft was the P-63, and the Air Force, the Army Air Corps, liked it so much they used it as a pinball aircraft. They up-armed it and painted it orange and put little lights on the side of it and flew it next to B-17s. And the B-17 gunnery people, like sticking the 50 cals out, and they shot at it. And when they knew they hit, it would light up. That's how you knew you were becoming a better gunner in a B-17 or a B-24 or any of the bombers. So what he has here is a picture of a P-63 King Cobra. Now, if you want to know the difference between a P-39 and a P-63, a P-63 has a pointed tail, and the really dead giveaway is it's got a four-bladed prop instead of the three-blade of the P-39. So that's what your aircraft is. So I don't know whose bet I settled, but I want 50% of the take.
I think it was a coffee, so I'm going to have to come down and give you half a coffee. Now, I'll buy a full coffee on that one.
I was going to say, we're due for beer, so we'll...
Yes, we'll definitely hook up then. That's for sure. What's interesting about this picture, some people might notice when we do put it in the show notes, there's a name at the bottom of it. It's an Air Force base. It's called Sampson Air Force Base, and that is no longer around, is it, David?
Not that I'm aware of. If it is, it's probably plowed under the ground of some...
Where
like
was it?
Most of the it was on Long Island.
Yeah,
this photograph looks like it was taken quite some time ago.
It was, and I just again, this is I'm going through somebody's flight bag, Just going, you know, through a relative flight back, finding all sorts of neat stuff like this. There's just like the Cradle of Aviation Museum and some of the people that started that, having so many of these pictures. So I'll have to share some of those with you folks, because I know you guys are really into that geeky stuff, which, you know, most of our
We are.
So quick check on the Sampson Air Force Base. I had looked it up when we first started the show, and I came up with it being up in the Finger Lakes region of New York State, which I kind of surprised
maybe,
me. Because,
I thought it was Long Island.
Okay. I stand corrected.
Well, and that's the part of Pennsylvania I grew up in, just south of the New York Finger Lakes. So I thought, oh, this is my neck of the woods.
Yeah, because when you said Buffalo, that makes sense. Yeah,
yeah, I was going to say that would make more sense because the Bell plant was actually in Buffalo.
Gotcha. And it may, I know, I'm pretty sure it was out in the middle somewhere in New York State, because I remember them talking about going out to Harris Hill, which is where they have the glider competitions.
Yeah, right next to Elmira.
Horse heads.
Yes, but it's interesting, all this, and like I said, we could talk all night about aviation and history, couldn't we? But I know that now everybody's going to be looking on their computers trying to find the Sampson, S-A-M-P-S-O-N Air Force Base. But David, by the way, I know somebody who can answer this question, and it's interesting, what threw everybody off is what you just mentioned, and it was the four-bladed propeller. They're like, oh, wait a minute, why is a four-bladed propeller on that? And I'm glad you just answered that. Awesome. Awesome, man.
Yeah.
And they're already up. All of the photographs are uploaded in the Dropbox already, Max. So.
Great. Put them in the show notes.
Carl, I was wondering if you can help us with something here. We have been looking for a very particular scholarship, one that would apply to podcasters who are retired from Pratt & Whitney. So have anything that would help get Max into the cockpit?
I do have scholarships, but they're for current employees at Pratt & Whitney. I'm not sure. And people who are retired that have children, if you have children, yes. To go further, no. But I tell you what, there is podcasting scholarships out there, not specific to aviation. So you can look toward those.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'll definitely try to hook you up there, Max. I think that would be important, you know, to make sure we have scholarships. There's scholarships, by the way, for everything. It's incredible. I mean, I think it's just terrific. You just have to get out there and look for them. And you have to apply, because you can't win it if you're not in it, as they say.
Right. Carl, tell everybody where we can find the podcasts and the resources that we've been talking about, where we can find you online, all that good stuff.
Sure. Thanks, Max. And obviously, we've been talking a lot about career. So aviationcareerspodcast.com. If you have questions, feedback at aviationcareerspodcast.com, and we answer them online. We obviously do career coaching and all there. But we also have another podcast, Stuck Mike Adcast. That's kind of how I got my start into the podcasting realm. And we've been doing that for years and helping out there at Sun and Fun. And because I like Sun and Fun so much, I decided to move to off the end of the runway 23 there in Lakeland. So if you're in Lakeland, look me up, and I'll show you around the radio station. It's right there on the grounds. If you're at Sun and Fun, come look for us and all the other airplane geeks folks and all the other podcasters. We'll be out there all week. And that's at liveatc.net/SNF. You can find us there at Aviation Careers Podcast, Stuck Mike Avcast. And if you're at all interested in flight team starting one at your college, let me know, and I'll try to talk you out of it. It's a lot of work. No, I'm just kidding. I'll give you some advice on how to get one started, because it's a really great thing for the students at your college.
All right, well, yeah, let's talk about Sun and Fun a little bit, because I'm planning to be there. Max Trescott's going to be there. Launchpad Merzari is going to be there. And in fact, I'm told we're scheduled to be on Sun and Fun Radio Live on Wednesday, which would be April 3rd, 2019. And you'll be able to hear us through that, also through atc.net, as Carl just said. I'm not sure what time we're on. I don't remember. I think it's maybe late in the afternoon, something-ish like that.
So usually you follow the schedule for the air show, and then either it's going to be the afternoon before the show, or it's going to be after the air show. Usually we do the live broadcast after the air show. So if there's a night show, and I'm not sure if there is right there, I didn't look yet, but Just look at the schedule for Sun and Fun, and that's flysnf.org. You can find all the information about Sun and Fun, and also maybe even helping out or seeing what the schedule is.
Yeah, yeah. I think Launchpad said that we were on before the air show.
Before? Okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Launchpad, by the way, he's done a great job. He's volunteered every year at Sun and Fun that I know of, and he's done a wonderful job.
Yes, that'll be my first time to Sun and Fun, so I'm not exactly sure what I can expect to find.
So it's really easy. As far as the show is concerned, it's a lot smaller than the other show, which we don't mention when we're on the on the radio at Sun and Fun Radio.
Oh, that's good to know. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, just a heads up there. And not that we're not friendly to them, but obviously there's a lot going on. This is the largest expo in the state of Florida. And we have, you know, well over 250,000 people will show up through this event. And there's different vendors that are showcasing their products, their airplanes. There's also the Warbird Ranch ramp. I'd really highly recommend you going over there. During the show, usually in the mornings, we have the women Air Force service pilots that are right down the block from us. They come over and we do interviews there. We interview a lot of the air show pilots. We also have, as volunteers, podcasters that come on, and also local radio personalities will come on and help out. And it's right near Honda Generators, across the street from Honda Generators, and also next to the Sunset Grill. We've been there for 25 years. 1510 a.m. is what you can listen to if you're listening on the AM radio station. It's not the strongest signal, so I'd suggest getting out your device, downloading landofatc.net, looking up Sun and Fun, or just LAL for the Lakeland Airport. And click play if you want to hear what's been happening since last year. You can listen to some of the interviews. And there's some really, really cool interviews that happen at the show. You're going to, you know, Matt Youngkin, you're going to see Patty Wagstaff. You'll hear from Max Trescott. I mean, people like Max Flight. I mean, people that are really out there that you hear in your head or you see out there at air shows. And really, it's a wonderful opportunity for you to actually meet some of those podcasters. And we have a big deck out front. We just ask people to kind of be quiet when they're coming up there, especially if the red lights are on. But please do say hello, and you'll see some of your, you know, some really cool aviators. We always have Story Musgrave. He always shows up, one of the astronauts, and a lot of other really inspirational people. And gosh, we're talking aviation. It could be more fun than that.
Yeah, could be better.
Waffles! Waffles.
Oh, waffles. Oh, I shouldn't. Yeah. Yeah. And we are famous for our waffles at Sun and Fun Radio. But we can't talk too much about it. It's like a secret society, the Waffle Society here.
Okay. Sorry, Dave.
But the other thing, too, is kind of like over at Oshkosh, we have Camp Radioactive, and that's where all the folks on the radio station camp out. And this is the beginning of March, and some of the people are already there camping out. I've been hanging out with them every so often, going over to the campground. Like I said, I'm right down the road from them, so it's been wonderful to see. Oh, and by the way, one thing I should mention about Sun and Fun, and one thing we really need to put forth, is that Sun and Fun is not just a one-week event. There's stuff that goes on all year long. They have a large high school flying club there. They also have different events for children, for young children, for teenagers. We have actually on campus a high school that's right there, Central Florida Aerospace Academy. And they have many different community outreach programs that happen just about every month. And right there is the pilot malls there. So everything, there's so much aviation going on there. It's really a lot of fun, and it's cool. And you can come on the campus anytime and take a look at the different airplanes. And, of course, there's the museum there that has some incredible exhibits. And my favorite, of course, because my friends have flown for them, is the Red Barons. I don't know if you remember them, the biplanes. They have one of those in the ceiling, hanging from the ceiling, which is really, really cool. Red Barons pizza. Yeah, so it's like I said, I love Sun and Fun. I've been going for so many years, for decades, been volunteering there, and now I'm actually volunteering for the organization of Sun and Fun and what they do for students and the money that is collected, by the way. And people say, oh, the tickets might be a little expensive. A lot of that goes to these programs that help students and help people get scholarships so they can move forward in their careers and in their lives.
Cool. I can't wait. It's going to be an exciting week. Plus, I'll be flying in with Dispatcher Mike is the plan. So, and I think we'll be at Camp Radioactive. What does that mean, camping? Does that mean like tents or
Some people have both. There's they're actually moving forward at Sun and Fun. They're the recreational association for campers has actually been there, and they actually wanted full hookups. So there's full hookups, and there's tent camping. Just remember, if you do want to camp, most of the sites have already been taken that have full hookups. The other ones, if you do have a motorhome, you do have to turn it off at night, your generator, because it has to be quiet. But the majority of people either sleep under the wings of their aircraft, or they sleep in tents. As a matter of fact, dispatcher Mike, he actually came to my place because his place was a little bit wet. I had a whole bunch of people at my house last year because of the rainstorm at the end. And the funniest thing about dispatcher Mike, remember this, is that my wife, I mean, they're sitting here having, you know, dinner and stuff like that, and my wife's trying to tell him about the weather and to be careful about his flight back. And I look at her, I said, you do realize he's a dispatcher for a large airline. He does know how to read the weather. And here's my wife, who's not in aviation, giving Mike a briefing, a weather briefing. And he was so gracious. He didn't say, he just smiled. But that's Mike. He's a terrific guy. And just a neat guy and just a wealth of knowledge, too. And just so much fun to be around. I mean, he really is a very strong advocate for GA, and he loves flying, which is really cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. All right, a few more What's Up with the Geeks items. Max Trescott, have you got something?
I do. We had episode 101 last week of Aviation News Talk, and it was very, very different. It was a narrative-style podcast, the kind of episode you might hear on NPR where they tell a story. And the story was all about a student pilot who, on her solo flight, I guess she had 4 hours of solo time, suddenly found the windshield covered with oil while she was out soloing around. And so we interviewed both the pilot, the controller, and have the air traffic control audio from the actual event and piece it all together with narration. And it has turned out to be one of our most popular episodes ever, just 4 or 5 days after it was released. So if you're interested in a really good story, but has a lot of twists and turns, she had multiple landing attempts. And all I can say is they handled it well.
And you have a photo, don't you, of the oil-covered windscreen?
We do. After she was successfully back on terra firma, she took a picture from inside the cockpit. Actually, it was video. And the thing that was really most eye-opening to me was that you really can't see through a windshield covered with oil.
No, it was really scary.
I had always thought, oh, sure, you probably can, you know, see something. It's like, not really.
No, doesn't work. All right, good. Last weekend, I was up at the New England Air Museum for the Women Take Flight event, which was fantastic. There were a lot of kids there, obviously a lot of young girls, but also some young boys as well. And they just had a great collection of speakers and others that had tables set up around for the kids to talk to and participate in some activities. And let me tell you, you could see it in the kids' eyes. A lot of them just had their eyes, let's say, opened to the possibilities of what they could do in their life with aviation. And it was really amazing. I recorded a bunch of interviews, and we'll have them coming up. I talked with Marianne Cannon. She's Vice President of Commercial Engine Programs at Pratt & Whitney. Also, Shasta Ways. She flew around the world solo in a Beechcraft Bonanza. She has a fantastic story to tell about that, why she did it, and what she accomplished. I spoke with Christy Fleischman. She's an ex-Air Force pilot, now at Acrojet, promoting aviation to students. And there were some others I talked to. Some UConn students from their composites lab. The Connecticut chapter of the 99s were there. And Carl, I met some of the ladies who were going to be at Sun and Fun as well.
Excited to have them.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to that. Some other high school students that are competing for the Sikorsky Challenge I talked to also. So I think what we're going to do is when we're all either on the way or at Sun and Fun, we'll make these interviews the episode for that week. So that'll be coming up. Their next event at the New England Air Museum is March 24th, 2019. It's called Beyond the Bicep, The Real Story of Rosie the Riveter. And this sounds very interesting. A woman's going to speak there, Amanda Goodhart Parks. She's a historian, but she's studied the history of women and gender, and she's going to talk about Rosie the Riveter and all the implications of that. So that might be another good one. And then just a note, last episode we talked about the video of the F-35 demo team flight that was captured. And we'll put a link in the show notes to the Luke Air Force Base demo team's website. They have a schedule there. And Dave and I, we were talking about, where they were going to be close to us. And the New York International Air Show is on August 24th and 25th, 2019. That's at New York Stewart International Airport. And the F-35 demo team is going to be there. So I'm going to be there. The Blues will be there. The Geico Skytypers, David, as well. And I went to look at the website and noticed that there's an offer for early bird tickets that are 35% off. So if you want to attend that air show, you might want to grab the tickets while they're cheap. All right. David, anything up with you that we need to talk about?
No, I just want to go to sleep at this point, given that I had my first day of work.
I know, it's kind of hard to get back into it. We have a lot of listener mail, some really great stuff, and we're not going to have time to do all of it this episode, so some of it will have to carry over, but we can do a couple. We heard from Dave, who said on the last show there were comments from a previous C-5 pilot about knocking holes in runways. He said, when I was moving from the U.S. to Kandahar, Afghanistan in 2002, we flew on C-5s from Fort Bragg to Rhein-Main, Germany. There we transferred our equipment to C-17s to fly to Kandahar. Unfortunately, there were not enough C-17s, so they decided to fly two C-5s directly to Kandahar, which had originally been built by the U.S. Unfortunately, Dave says, when the aircraft landed, they caused significant damage due to the heavy aircraft weight and the poor conditions of the runway. We then had to switch back to the C-17s. He said his comment reminded me of those incidents early in Operation Enduring Freedom. He says, keep up the great work on the podcast. And I talked to a C-5 pilot at the New England Air Museum, the lady who flew the C-5, and I asked her about, because we were talking about, is there an altitude call-out that helps the pilot because you're so high up in the, high up off the runway. And she said there is, but, mostly, Max, she said the same thing that you said about, and she had a term for it, I can't remember, but you were talking about how you kind of, before you take off, sort of gauge your height, above the runway, sort of, what you see out the window, as it were.
Yes, because then when you go to land, you're going to be a little bit higher than that just before you touch down.
Yeah.
So, that's particularly important, especially if you're kind of switching aircraft to different heights and so on.
And she said it's the same thing with the C-5. You, you sort of learn, what the sight is.
Yeah, she probably used the phrase sight picture, which would be a
common, I think that's what she said.
Phrase.
Yeah, yeah. But she also noted that with the C-5, she said that you're supposed to land really firmly, she said. It's it sounds like it's a bit of a jolt maybe when you actually make contact with the runway. Then we heard from Bjorn. He says, you might remember, he's the A380 captain that flew into Dulles for the Innovations in Flight Pilot Day at Dulles last year. And I remember Bjorn. He says, a little feedback on the last episode with regards to the A380 I fly for a living. He says, all modern airliners, the 737, A320, et cetera, have auto call-outs on the radar altimeter during the last few hundred feet. This greatly helps the judgment of the flare in the landing. Older steam gauge airliners, like older 747s, the Concorde, and so forth, had the flight engineer call out the radar altitudes in the flare to achieve the same thing. He says the A380 has several cameras that the passengers can enjoy. I always love those in in airplanes. One on the tail overlooking the whole aircraft, one just behind the nose gear looking forward, and one looking below the aircraft, all available on the IFE. On the flight deck, we use the tail and forward-looking cameras to safely taxi the aircraft around, but do not use it for landings. He said, lastly, yes, I have had the joy of enjoying the Emirates first-class shower. Right? We were talking about that last week, and I think I made the comment that it's probably just barely big enough for one. Well, as he says, he's enjoyed the first-class shower many times. There's nothing as refreshing as taking a nice shower on a long 15-hour flight. The setup is actually quite large, the size of a good-sized bathroom at home. At Emirates, it's called the shower spa, as it is much more than just a tiny shower cabin. So he sends a picture that shows this, and this is a lot nicer and a lot bigger than the bathroom in my house, let me tell you. And this is on the A380. I don't know. Carl, you don't fly anything that's got a shower in it.
No, and if it does, there's an issue. But, yeah, it's actually interesting because, you know, usually I'm bumping my head against the wall. Here you can kind of stretch out, and there's like maybe even five people that can get inside this. The only thing I've ever seen a shower in is a corporate jet, and boy, nothing like this. This is phenomenal.
This is amazing.
Yes, I was on a Boeing business jet recently, and yep, pretty amazing stateroom in the back.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I was assuming it'd be something like, you know, what you see in a motorhome or something like on a sailboat, something of that sort. But yeah, this is pretty posh. But Bjorn notes, he said, besides the passion for aviation, he's also a very active photographer, and he's got some aviation photography at his site. And so we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And then on batteries, we've been talking about lithium polymer cells, and we were kind of speculating about, you know, is LiPo the same thing as lithium ion or subset, or, you know, what's the story here in terms of restrictions on them? And we heard from Sam Abdelsamid, who says in this week's show, Max West commented on the apparent distinction in airline cargo rules regarding lithium cells. He says lithium polymer cells are just a subset of lithium ion. They use a polymer gel electrolyte rather than a liquid electrolyte. However, they still work basically the same way and are all part of a group generically known as lithium ion. There are also many different chemistry blends that all incorporate lithium, including lithium titanate, lithium cobalt oxide, and lithium nickel manganese cobalt. That they have varying properties of energy, density, and power. In all cases, he says, it's the electrons that are pulled off the lithium atoms to travel across the terminals, while the lithium ions traverse between the anode and the cathode. So thanks to Sam for that. Sam knows this stuff. Sam is a analyst at Navigant Research, and Sam is involved in some other tech shows that you may have heard his name. So we appreciate Sam giving us a little clarification on lithium ion batteries. All right, maybe we can do one more. We have a recording that came in from Jeremy, and he's talking about Tokyo's Haneda Airport. And let's listen to Jeremy.
Hello, my name is Jeremy, and I currently live in Switzerland. A few weeks ago, you guys were talking about airports that have great observation decks. I used to be based in Japan. In fact, I lived in Tokyo for 11 years. The main airport that serves the international community is Narita Airport, which does not have a good observation deck. However, Tokyo's second airport, which is actually busier, I think it's the fourth busiest in the world, Haneda International Airport, has three unbelievably great observation decks at the airport, accessible without going through security, as well as a ton of other observation areas around the airport, accessible with public transportation, and two museums, one for Japan Airlines, which is free, and one for All Nippon Airways, which is not free, but also worth it. It's probably the best airport for airplane geeks who don't have cars and big tripods. It's located right by the sea, so you can actually even take a cruise at night or during the day and get right up close, right under landing airplanes or airplanes that are taking off. Anyways, if anyone's going to Japan, it is totally worth a day or even 2 days to explore all the viewing spots. Great pictured places, amazing, all sorts of airplanes. Okay, hope you guys have a wonderful afternoon, day, whatever. Sorry to make my message so long, but I hope someone can go out there to Japan because it really is heaven for airplane geeks. Unlike Switzerland, where I am now, and there are only A320s. Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, I used to fly into Narita fairly frequently on business trips, which, ironically, the meetings were all over at Haneda Airport. But back then, that was kind of primarily a domestic airport, kind of smallish, sort of, at least compared to Narita. Yeah, Narita didn't have much. I would hang out in the United Lounge at the time, and you got a pretty good view of the runway, actually. But just sort of as a general observation area, it was kind of lacking. So yeah, it's exciting to hear that at Haneda that they've got something a little more exciting. Carl, have you flown international at all?
Not to international, meaning Europe. No, yeah. Most of it's been like South America, that kind of area. Yeah, just Peru, you know, Colombia, that type of thing. Now most people, I guess, consider flying international going over the pond there. Maybe, who knows? I might wind up doing it, but I love the South American and Caribbean flying.
So, do pilots ever hang out at the airport and watch the planes land, or is that just for everybody else? So you guys get enough of it already?
It depends on who you are. I mean, some do, some don't. I think, you know, it depends. It really depends on your background. Some guys are into general aviation and airplanes, and some are not. But it's always fun, you know, going down to, like, St. Martin, hanging out at the airport and or the little bar there and just looking at the airplanes take off and land. And but in general, there's a lot of guys that don't even want to see an airplane after they get off it, and they've been around them for so long. But it is, I think it's still fun to see all the cool things that are flying out there. And I still like to look at A320s, even though I know your listener was getting sick of seeing them over there in Switzerland. They're quite prevalent there, but yeah, it is interesting though when you talk to people, they do get into some really intricate detail on certain things. And there's a lot of guys, especially where I am, that own warbirds, you know, like T6s and they own Stearmans and things like that. So most of them are kind of getting their kicks that way, more so than looking at airliners. They love old airplanes, and I get it, you know.
Yeah,
we're hanging around.
Yeah, sure. All right. So we'll wrap it up here. We've got quite a lot of other great listener feedback. We'll roll over to next week's episode. Meantime, we want to thank you for listening to episode 543 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Of course, you can always find us at airplanegeeks.com, or if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/543. Carl Valeri, we want to thank you so much for coming back on that. We have to have you back more often, I think. Looking forward to seeing you at Sun and Fun. Once again, tell our listeners where they can find you online.
First of all, it's a pleasure always being here, and I love hanging out with you guys, and you really love what you're doing, and it definitely shows everybody that's ever been on this podcast. And to find me, the aviationcareerspodcast.com and StuckMikeAvcast.com. That's the best way to find us. And during Sun and Fun, don't forget liveatc.net/SNF. Your favorite Max and Max will be on there.
Yeah. I hope I can live up to my. That's live, right? Nobody edits that.
So there's the live show that goes on, and we actually broadcast that live, but also. Gosh. Afterwards, we take the interviews and we do replay those. So those are edited, the interviews and the ones that are done in the field. But also, here's another thing. If you're wanting to listen to the show go on, we actually broadcast the live show, the actual air show. They take it over at the Air Show Center, and you can listen to all the different air show performers and right on liveatc.net/SNF. But you will hear all those interviews throughout the year, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, very nice. All right, David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online? when you come off mute.
I'm working on it. You didn't want to hear me snoring, did you?
Jeez. Yeah, we got to get you into bed for... You have another big day of work tomorrow, don't you?
Yeah, it's the second day in a row. I'm not used to this. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Slack listener team, and we want you to be part of that. You can do that by sending an email to us at feedback. Oh, I did it again.
I know, it's the other show.
You got to do it the other show. You can send us a email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and Max or I will send you an invite to join the fun and games that are on our Slack listener team. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAVdigest.com.
Great. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, I am right there in the middle of your podcast style at aviationnewstalk.com, and we talk about everything related to general aviation. And if you want to send me an email, just go to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top, and you can send any feedback or listener questions, which I answer on the show. And I'm always happy to hear from people.
Cool. And you can find me on LinkedIn. Let's look for Max Flight, as David said, at theuavdigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at paxxpodcast.com. In fact, we're going to record another episode this week, so it's going to be another a three-podcast episode week for me. Oh, my gosh. If you'd like to send me an email, that's maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions, where he incorporates aviation sounds, at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Safe flying.
And thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few...